Welcome to the Soul Sisters series, where you'll get thought-driven, inspiring topics for your soul with Vaughn Solis and Brenda Rachel. Okay, so welcome to another episode of Soul Sisters. I am Vaughn.
I am Brenda.
And together we are the Soul Sisters. So welcome to part four of this series. So last week in part three, we talked about exit points. We talked about close calls we have with actual experiences where we could have died. And we talked about coming from trauma and dysfunction and how not to stay there. And then we started a little introduction on manifesting. And so today we're going to be talking about the contrast between living in pain of whatever type and basically not wanting to be on the planet, but the contrast with that and having a spiritual life where everything is perfect and whole and we don't need to suffer. So welcome to this episode and let's get started, sis.
Okay.
So I wanted to open up with this idea of we've both experienced pain.
Oof.
And so for anybody out there, I don't want to speak for you, but we kind of sort of touched in a couple episodes ago that you've come from a lot of physical pain.
Yes.
Which you really document quite a lot in your book, your most recent book. And I come from mostly pain in the bereavement, in the loss of, you know, the suicide with my daughter in 2005. So they're very different experiences, but what I thought was really interesting as I was kind of thinking about today was that in both physical pain, it brings you to mental and emotional pain, and in mental and emotional pain, it brings you to physical pain.
Exactly. So I think the three, I was just going to say, so I really think the three are connected.
Yeah.
I believe that one precipitates the other.
Yeah.
And because our body and mind are connected. They're not disconnected from each other.
I agree. 100%. So what I wanted to do is just talk a little bit about and share with the audience, share with you audience. You come from a history of fibro, so I'm going to let you, talk about that and you can open it up. And then I'm going to talk just really high level, you know, about my loss of Janaea. And the point I want to make here is when we're dealing with long-term struggle, and mine was certainly and has been very long-term, and I'm not completely over it, and I would wager you're going to speak about that, whether we're over it or not over it, because we're dealing here with the contrast of what I was saying earlier. Sometimes, and you and I have had numerous conversations, haven't we, about struggle and suffering.
Yes.
And this idea of when it feels better to die than live. And I'm going to be getting to that as a separate little subject today because there's a lot I want to say about that. But I want to just say, ask if you want to open up and start with your sort of journey a little bit high level with fibro. But essentially what I want to share with you audience, very few people get away pain-free in this life. And if you are struggling with, I'll just say it, not wanting to be here, or not even knowing how, you know, you're going to get through whatever it is that is just tearing you down right now or has already torn you down and you can't get back up. Well, we want to offer you some inspiration. So let's open it up and you start with how your physical struggles, if you think they started with fibro, and just what that impact, sort of almost in chapters, not what you did about it, but just overall impact. What it did to you physically, mentally, and emotionally.
I started being very ill in 1994 and right through to 1996.
Right.
And so I wasn't diagnosed until 1996 with fibro.
Okay.
I always thought that I had a very bad flu, but I would always be off work like for much longer than normal people would be off with a bad flu. And finally, I found this wonderful doctor who diagnosed me, sent me to a rheumatologist. Who then did tests, and we found out what it was. However, prior to this, or when I was looking back at my history of these ill periods, I really had it since 1979.
How old were you in 79? Can't do the math.
Okay.
53. So, ooh, well, I gave away her birthday. Oops.
No, that's okay. No, that's okay. 53 to 79. So that's 25.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I'd be 26 in December.
So wait, so you know you got fibro, symptoms of fibro at 25?
Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Because and the reason being is because I would always, always be much, much sicker than other people at my work. And I could never explain it. And I always thought my supervisors my supervisors thought that I was just, you know, bucking the system kind of to take more time off.
Yeah.
When I was like very deathly ill in bed. And because there is no cure for it today, right?
Still.
Present day, there's no cure for it.
Yeah.
So it was very hard to diagnose what I had. And because the symptoms are so parallel to other things.
Yeah.
Right? So anyways, because it affects 9 areas of the body.
Oh.
And I had 7 of the 9 areas affected.
So if somebody thinks that they had fibro, like if you think you might have like something like fibro, is there like more research on it today online? Like if you wanted to go and find stuff, can you find out what these like 9 body parts are and all that stuff?
Yeah, they're called tender points.
Oh, okay.
So basically, you can just research fibromyalgia,
right,
and it'll tell you exactly what it is.
What to look for. So fast forward, you get diagnosed. How old were you when you were diagnosed?
That was 96. So
in your 40s?
Yeah.
About 50?
Right, 42.
About 40, 42. Okay. So was that diagnosis sort of a relief?
No, it wasn't, because the rheumatologist told me I'd likely end up in a wheelchair. And so I was 42, and that's what I was told in the appointment with her. And so from that moment, my mind took me to the place that, because I was alone.
Yeah.
With you guys weren't, you know, my family.
We were overseas, right?
Yeah, you guys were away.
Yeah.
And I was coping with everything by myself.
Here's a question just for the audience. So
you
go right to the end. So Brenda's told you're going to end up in a wheelchair. Maybe somebody watching this or listening to this has been told the same thing or something similar, but a horrible prognosis.
Well, for me, because I was very, very active in rafting and all kinds of hiking, rafting, outdoors. I had my dog, walking.
Oh, yeah.
I was outdoors after, my work life.
Yeah.
Nature and being outside was like part and parcel of who my being was.
Yeah. And just a fun fact, I'm at the coffee shop or, you know, a nice lounge enjoying a nice
yeah,
hike in a fireplace.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just had to throw that in.
For me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Inside, outside.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's the thing. When do you think that, and this is just an opinion. I have no idea if people do this, but do you think it's natural to kind of go to that end prognosis and get stuck there? Do you think so?
Well, absolutely. Because at that time,
they,
in 1996, they had no cause and they had no cure. So right now they have no cure, but they have sort of defined what the causes are.
Right.
And people can research that on.
Yeah, of course.
For more.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, we're just talking about Brenda's situation.
So I'm here with a diagnosis that nobody can do anything for.
Wow.
And nobody knows anything really about it.
Yeah.
So
that will have impacted, or should I just ask you, did this impact?
This didn't impact me with not wanting to be here anymore.
No. What I was going to actually say was, did this impact you in immediately, like more severely physically? Like now that you have this like prognosis, a diagnosis, a prognosis, how long did you struggle with that? Like how many years? Like what did that do to you?
Well, this was in 1996 after 2 years of extreme, extreme ill health.
Yeah.
And then I finally found the new doctor who sent me to the rheumatologist. So this was at the end of my journey of finding out what all the years from 1979 up to 1996 had been about.
Okay.
So it wasn't like all of a sudden I'm given this information and I can now deal with it. Now it was like, okay, this is what's been happening to me in my life and what's going on in my body.
Yeah.
And you're going to end up in a wheelchair, likely to end up in a wheelchair, and there's no cause and there's no cure. And so, or we don't know the cause at this juncture. This was in 96. And there is no cure.
So what are you going through, like, mentally and emotionally with this information?
Well, I think what happened for me is somewhere in my psyche, and I'm not saying like right up front, but I just didn't know how much longer I could continue with living like this because I knew for me, I wasn't going to end up in a wheelchair. For me, and I have the highest regard for all of the people who are in wheelchairs.
Of course.
But I'm just saying for my own situation,
yeah,
that to me seemed like it was going to be a sentence worse than death.
Yeah.
So for me, because by myself, no support, no help, it was just,
yeah,
I couldn't fathom.
It was a mountain you weren't going to be able to climb,
right.
Literally. You know,
I had, yes, with no support system and whatever.
Right.
So anyway, what ended up happening, and then also what happened was my health really, really declined, of course, because the emotional, the mind,
yeah,
is feeding in to what it's been told.
Yeah.
And so the body is responding to the devastation of the emotional trauma of hearing this news. And so my body is just totally breaking down. And so
how many years did you go with the body breaking down before? And again, we're just audience staying kind of high level right now. Brenda does document this in her book, very detailed, and you break it down beautifully into chapters. If you want to remind them, what's the name of your book again?
Sure. My book is called Broken Spirit, Awakened Soul, My Journey of Healing with the Angels.
And we're going to have a link to that below and the work I do also. But I wanted to say I did read it. I actually learned a lot about you. This one sister actually reading her sister's book, and I loved it. And that's actually what kickstarted this whole Soul Sister series. We've been talking about it, but it was like once I read that, I went, wow, we have so many experiences that are so similar, but they come from, you know, we come from just such polar opposite places. That's the reason we're doing this. We're doing it as help for others, but we're also leaving it as a legacy for each other, which we think is really cool.
No, we do.
We
love each other so much.
Because we talk a lot about when one or the other is gone. Of course, this one thinks she's going first, but you never know. But because I want to live to like 102,
yeah,
she might be right.
Yeah.
But anyway, what a beautiful gift that we're leaving each other.
Yeah.
And talking about these things are really important because the more I talk to people, I've told you this, right? Some of the really deep stuff, like I really want to talk about, is with you and you know, and really hash it out, which we do all the time.
Yeah.
So
I just want to interject here.
Yeah.
So from 94 to 96, I really just tried to do my best. I continued working and doing all this kind of stuff, but I finally went off on disability in May of 1996.
Was this after the diagnosis?
Yes.
So now you go on disability.
I go on disability. Exactly.
Was that the start? You had several disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the start of your several disabilities in 96?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And again, Brenda documents a lot of that in her book. So what I want to get at, so you're faced with this life sentence, death sentence, you know, two different things, but kind of the same. And so fast forward, what was the age that you had your turning point? Like your absolute turning point, I'm staying on the planet. So you go on all these disabilities from 1996 over a period of a number of years.
Yeah, I had four altogether between then and 2016.
And 2016. So that's 20 years. That's 20 years. Wow.
See, I never even looked at it. Yeah.
Wow.
Well,
what I'm trying to do is build chronologically.
Yeah.
So during that 20-year period, what kept you going
and motivating you when you still hadn't tapped into like the purpose work that you're doing that really is a motivator from 2015 on?
Yeah.
What kept you going when you're just dealing with this in sort of the physical?
Oh, okay. Well, that was my conscious suicide attempt and I didn't die. And so from that...
What year was that?
96.
Oh,
that was,
that
wasn't because I had a purpose.
No, no, I know.
It was just because that was the turning point for me.
1996.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go on disability.
Yeah.
And I just
want to let people know. So I didn't just get this prognosis and then say, I'm going to dump.
No, no, no.
I'm going to kill myself. I actually went for help
No, I know. So we're not going to talk in deep about that, but Brenda really details that again. And if you want to learn more about that, please get her book. It's just such an eye opener.
Yeah. I did try to get help in two places through crisis center and a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And help wasn't available for me.
And I just want to say 2023, it's still a problem. We live in BC and it is still a problem getting a referral for help, getting the actual support. And so it's wonderful. We have all this advocating and, you know, we're going to increase services and stuff, but there are a lot of people, and you might even be one of them, struggling out there that, yeah, right. And grief is very similar. Okay. There's some, not saying there isn't. And kudos to every bit of support in our various areas that we're looking for help, but it's still very, very limited here in Canada, at least. I've talked to some American friends and, professional people, and they say the same thing. And I imagine it's around the world. What I'm trying to get at here is when you're in that space, mm-hmm. So we know that you did have a suicide attempt,
yep.
Which we're not talking about today, yep. But it was a turning point for you. So from that turning point in 1996, mm-hmm. You're still not tapped in to all the beautiful work that you didn't discover several years later.
Right.
No. So so what kept you going? Because what I'm trying to get at here, people, is when we make a choice and go, okay, I'm staying on the planet. And if you aren't even inclined and struggling with this, I don't want to be here. And it's not about attempting suicide, nothing like that. It's just about being very, very sad and distressed and uncomfortable and regretful and just all those and depressed, right?
Well, it was none of those things.
Oh, actually. But for me, it was.
Oh, for you, I'm sorry. I thought we were
No, but for me, and some people are going to be feeling like that. Mm-hmm. But if you're given this, you're going to end up in a wheelchair. You survive a suicide attempt, but then you still don't know why you're on the planet. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming you didn't know that for several more years. Mm-hmm. And you're going to your job and you're doing the thing. Mm-hmm. Where do you get your motivation from? Where do you get that inspiration from to go? And I don't even know if you were saying, I'm going to beat this, or you were going, I'm just going to live with this until I can't live with it anymore. Like, well, what were you going through?
It was more... for me to make the decision not to try to kill myself again. So that wasn't the first part of the thought pattern that came into my mind.
Right.
Was just that I will never try. I promised the angels I would never try to kill myself again.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew they had created the divine intervention for me to remain on the planet. So from that moment till 2004, when I was off with my feet,
mm-hmm.
and then I got my first purpose work through them.
Okay.
With my music.
Okay. So that was about 8 years. So that was about 8 years later.
2004. For that 8 year period.
Yeah.
It was not about, oh, I want to be on this planet. It was like, I will not kill myself to leave the planet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you just sort of lived.
Yeah.
You went about your business.
Totally existed.
And lived. Do you think you embrace life, or you're just sort of in this indifferent, I don't know, like
I totally embraced life, because I was that's when I really, really embraced all my paddling and
Thinking. Oh, really?
I mean, I continued it, but in full force.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what gave me my motivation to be here, was all my outdoor activities.
And, right. Because you made a promise to yourself or anyone else, but that there was divine intervention. I'm not meant to leave the planet.
Right.
Did I get that right?
Well,
not even so much I'm not meant to leave the planet.
I won't leave the planet. Purposely.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So for me, a little bit high level, and I'll speak to the bereavement part. Again, this is wrapped in the context of when you're living with a pain. Basically, I think all pain is pretty much the same at its root. I mean, it hurts and it's making us suffer in some way. So losing my daughter, Janae, in 2005, becoming a bereaved parent in July 2005, and my girl left me, you know, like my girl freaking left me. And I did have my son, and I love him completely and thoroughly and as much as I loved her. But it's different when you are like a mom daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And even to this day, it's like super hard for me in a nail salon, you know, with mom and daughter day. Oh, I'm sorry. I respect all you moms and daughters. I'm super happy for you. But it's very hard for me still, certain situations. Mm-hmm. And so, but in the beginning of my bereavement, and I would say up until that point, I had lived a very purposeful life from the time I was 25 because I was brought to, I wouldn't say my purpose, but I was absolutely brought to my knees, hence embraced a spiritual practice. You and I talked about this right way back in part one, when I thought I was going to lose her, ironically, when I was 6 months pregnant and I'd only gained 4 pounds. And so I had gone for an ultrasound and they told me at the hospital that she was just fine, but I better eat. And I was going through a breakup with her dad. And so, you know, sometimes you are, you know, you think you're eating. I thought I was eating. I wasn't eating. And anyway, so the total of that, and at the end of that pregnancy, when she was born, I'd only gained 13 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. And so for me, she was my miracle. Mm-hmm. And she was, now I wasn't struggling with wanting to leave the planet, obviously, at this point, but she was the miracle for me that was like opened me up to wanting to be the best I could be. And therefore I knew I couldn't do that just on my own. So that's when I started getting into a spiritual practice and continued it until she passed away at the age of 22. So 22 years later. And so I'd been in my spiritual practice at that point for 23 years. So those beginning hours, literally hours, days, weeks, because everything just slowed down and it was such a grind. And I'm just being really honest here and acknowledging that for people because it can be like that. And to get me out of the darkness, you had gotten me into angels. They were my lifesaver.
Yeah, mine too.
Oh my God, they were my lifesaver. So that's like 18 years ago. I got into angels 19 years ago. Just 8 months or so before she died, yes, I could say transcended and into the afterlife. And I do often talk about that. But today I'm talking the hardcore physical loss. She's dead, right? In physical.
Yeah.
I can't go clothes shopping with her necessarily in the afterlife. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about that physical pain where you just go, I can't do this. That's where, similar to your situation, like death looks better than living.
Absolutely.
So I struggled for a long time with that. Never, ever, ever, entertaining the idea at all, I would take my own life. But because I didn't trust myself, let's just put it this way, I never went and asked for Valium from a doctor. To get through those horrendous first few weeks and months. I did not do that. I obviously had something ingrained and inbuilt within me enough that I took care of myself to the best of my ability. So I think that my purpose at that time was definitely my son, mm-hmm. you know, your nephew. Mm-hmm. He is my purpose. And I did the best I could, which was very limited for the first, for sure, year, maybe two. But his dad stepped in. We were married. So he, you know, was 24/7. He stepped in and sort of took over a lot of those responsibilities. But I think for me, a turning point was when we went to train as angel therapy practitioners mm-hmm. with Doreen Virtue.
Yeah.
And that fire ceremony we went through, which we went through a fire ceremony. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And you basically wrote, you know, you wrote what you wanted to release or what you wanted to intend in any way. You threw it and you know, wrapped it around this rock and put it into this fire pit that was through a ceremony. It was really kind of cool. And I made a commitment then that I was going to, once again, similar to when I was pregnant, be the best, or when she was born, I guess, be the best I could be me for her. And that's what kept me going. So I think the point I want to make, and you can speak to this, is we need to find something to grab onto when something threatens to take us out, whether it's loss or, you know, some kind of physical, you know, illness, disease, whatever is going to incapacitate us. And what I will say, and I'd love you to say, you know, what you think about this too, for your own self. I'm just starting, and you would probably know this, but I'm just starting in kind of like the last year, maybe even just the last few months, because every time I try and put a timeline on it, I think, no, it didn't start back then. But the stronger I get, I'm starting to live for me, not live just for my daughter. And some of you will understand what I'm saying there. It's like, needing and wanting to be the best I can be, it switched from needing and wanting to do that for Jenea, largely so as not to tarnish her memory and make it wrong that she left. And if I allowed my life to be ruined by that, what does that say about her choice, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, very brief, very generally. And I just wanted to, So I just wanted to say your thoughts on that, ask your thoughts on that, but also say when we reach that point, I think it's great if we start out inspired and motivated. And I might not even say inspired at this point, just motivated. And it's not yet for us and coming from within us. It's something we can see just down ahead a little bit. A-okay, because I'm a firm believer if we keep to that road, one day we will feel inspired and one day we will be doing it for us. What do you think? You agree?
Yes, I do. And I guess in my situation, I just wanted to make sure that I let people know as part of my journey, I was always, always involved in some kind of spiritual practice. So I'd never not been, whether it was a Christian church or the Baha'i faith or non-denominational churches or an Anglican church or whatever. I've always, always, even through my suicide attempt, et cetera, like I was always connected to spirit. And so for me, I never made wanting to leave the planet like a sin or anything like that, because I didn't believe that. I believed it was a choice for me to be here or not be here, and that was my choice. And that had nothing to do with whether or not spirit loved me or I love spirit or I can have any kind of relationship with an external God presence, because I believe that I'm just at one at all times with my spiritual source. We're never disconnected.
Yeah. It's wonderful that you had that. And I think faith is really important. I've talked to a lot of bereaved parents, people who've come from difficulty, and we all kind of circled back to we all had faith in something.
Yeah.
Faith does not necessarily have to be God, religion, anything that, you know, is coming from what we would traditionally connect faith to. It can come from just, you know, faith. I know I need to wake up tomorrow morning and feed my fish. I have faith that I'm going to do that. And, you know, and some of you may, you know, disagree with that, and that's okay. And some of you may ponder that a bit, but that's kind of how I had to look at it, because when Jenea died, all that kind of stuff, on too intricate or even too big a level, it was too much for me to consider. So all I could do was break up my day into three parts and just be, you're putting your feet on the floor and you're getting out of bed and then you're going to go and do this. Mm-hmm. And I guess I had faith in myself that I was going to do that. And here we are 18 years later. And that's why it feels kind of like when I try and put a timeline on, and I'm just thinking about this now, actually, you know, how well I'm doing and, you know, how much more independent and how much stronger I'm feeling, because I literally had to build myself from nothing. It feels like I can't put a timeline on it because I'm making so much progress, which might not feel like anything to someone else, but to me, it's huge. Mm-hmm. Like, it's huge. And so it's very hard to kind of gauge that. But I just know every day I feel in some way a little bit stronger than I did the day before. And, you know, okay, so there might be some days that are hard. But basically, I was saying the other day, you know, to myself and actually to another person, I am living a life that is very content and, you know, in every way that I want to be living it. And so I think that's a sign of faith in oneself and also that whatever we trust in will deliver, mm-hmm. which kind of goes to the manifesting piece. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. I'll just throw in here too that so you and I were both broken souls who yeah. had to build ourselves back up from scratch.
Yeah.
And each from a different place.
Yeah.
But we both had to rebuild ourselves.
And again, I'm acknowledging that Brenda lost her beautiful niece. She does have another beautiful niece. And we also have one nephew. You know, that kind of grief doesn't really get talked about a lot. So it can become very difficult for siblings and even sisters when there is a loss, because it you know, you do lose the sister that you had.
Oh, absolutely. You and I have not really ever talked about my grief through losing.
No. And I'm not the right person to talk to you about it.
No. And you said that many times.
Yeah.
You told me that. No, and I understand that. But not forgetting, I did lose a niece.
Absolutely. And the reason I say I'm not the right person for Brenda to talk to is because the kind of support you need to have it from someone who understands it. So you need to talk to other aunties.
Yes.
And and as far as I'm aware, there's not a lot of support for that.
Yeah.
Really, there's not. And I was just talking to somebody and I was asking them if there was support for parents who lose their only child and there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine? And so like they need that too.
Yeah.
So every type of grief, just like an illness, you know, if you got fibro, you're not going to go to a cancer support group.
Right. Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So grief needs to be broken down into exactly the type of support we offer for our various diseases, physical diseases. I did kind of skip over, but I just want to acknowledge I did suffer a lot of physical ailments. Mine were not critical, but just like you, you know, having to be always on sick and not recovering like other people would, I went through the exact same thing. When I went back to work in 2009, I mean, really back to work. I did some odd jobs before that, but I went back to work when I felt like, I guess I could kind of do that job. And because I had basically lost touch with my abilities and did not understand I could do more than work at a gas station. All due respect to anyone that works in, you know, and cashier, gas stations, liquor stores. I loved selling the liquor, by the way, but I wasn't drinking it. But, you know, it was like there was something repetitive about sliding the bottle through the scanner. But I was diagnosed with PTSD in 2014. So 9 years later, and I understand that pattern was soothing. You know, it's kind of like you can comb your hair, brush your hair, and you count the strokes, things like that. That's one way it soothes the trauma. Yeah,
I did not know that.
Yeah. And so I just loved sliding those bottles through. And I could never understand that. And I'm just kind of figuring that piece out now because I've long known that like counting or rhythm, so like a dance or drumming or just something like that
can really, it does something. And anyway, it definitely works to soothe my brain. And I'm much, 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 much better. Once I understood and had a diagnosis, and yes, this is what I have, it took another 4 years for me to embrace that and understand it and then go, okay, I'm going to manage this. Mm-hmm. And it is something I think an awful lot of bereaved people and suicide survivors and anybody else dealing with something like a traumatic death, I think it's missed a lot that people, the trauma piece of that, some of whom, you know, develop PTSD. So that's my piece. But interesting, see, the years of living with something, not getting it diagnosed, then getting it diagnosed, and then going, okay, this makes sense now. All these years I've been acting a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's just a touch of what we could otherwise end up talking about. So I just want to really give a nod really quickly here. We're talking about two more things today. I want to talk a little bit about the stigma of wanting to die. And the reason I want to talk about that is you actually mentioned it a little bit, you know, earlier that you sort of understood that dying was your part of everything and, you know, didn't make a big deal of it in your head. But culturally, we do make a big deal of mm-hmm. wanting to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, we are not talking here. We are no way encouraging anybody, you know, to not want to be on the planet. What we're doing here is trying to address if you do struggle with what am I here for? Pretty sure a lot of us do that. What am I here for? And if we didn't, I think, like, okay, you must be really lucky if you can just pop into this life and just be completely content without having anything super intentional. You know, I think that there must be people that are like that, and life is great. But when you start, you either have something happen to you, as we've been talking about today, that takes you down, or you are just someone who's has a very inquiring mind. We are searching for more. And I do, I can see where people, and I've spoken to people who are like empaths and that, they are greatly affected by world affairs and things like that. And it could be any number of things. It could be just something that, you know, you struggle with as what we would consider a difficult life experience, like tough finances, you know, relationship breakup, divorce, things like that, that, you know, I think probably every single one of us, for the most part, you know, experiences in one way or another. So it's just really high level. We're just talking really high level here about this fact that I'm going to say, and something I've been thinking about a lot, and I want to get your opinion on it, is your view on it, is, you know, if we here in Canada, we are introducing MAID, more than likely it's going to pass. I think it's next March. That is medically assisted death for people. It's on the table to be approved. I don't know exactly where the proposed, change to this MAID law is. Right now, it is designed to support people who are terminal, right, and physically expecting a death to, you know, have assistance in their transition. And so this change, if passed, that would allow then this same, is it a service? Honestly, I don't even know. Is MAID a service? I don't know. But they would be offering MAID to somebody who is challenged with mental, emotional problems and no longer wishes to be on the planet. You could apply for medically assisted death. In fact, we've had cases in Canada where people who were like disabled, had a disability of one way or another, and it wasn't so much that they wanted to die, it's that they felt they had no other choice because they weren't getting supported in any number of ways in their disability. Money for rent, a proper place to live that would support what they needed in their disability, things like that. And it has actually happened where people have chosen MAID. It's been
granted, and they've fallen into these already kind of stricter guidelines. So I'm not talking about made, but what I am, you know, I've been telling myself since they are wanting to open it up to these mental emotional issues, and possibly even some for minors to apply for without parental consent, which kind of worries me. But then I'm thinking to myself, okay, then we are going to have a very different conversation about suicide. And you may not even want to say anything, and that's okay. I'm just thinking about this right now. So when we talk about not wanting to be on the planet, that is not the same as suicidal ideation in the way I'm talking about it, not at all. It's coming from more spiritual place when we have this struggle to, you know, God, this world can be hard. I don't have that struggle. I did for about maybe 3 years. I don't, maybe four, I don't know. I don't anymore. But I want to just recognize and acknowledge and honor the people that do have trouble. And part of the reason I think it's just an even more difficult battle is because they feel that they have no one to talk to about it, because it's so frowned upon, right? And I'm not talking here either. I want to be really clear. I'm not talking about aiding and abetting anyone. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about for mental and emotional support here. I think it can be, well, I'm going to ask you, what are your thoughts? Do you think it's like when you didn't want to be on the planet, did you feel you had anyone you could talk to about that?
I phoned a crisis center. Then the Friday night of the, I'd already planned out when exactly I was going to do this. And so on the it was going to be on the Monday, the main long weekend Monday. And so on the Friday night, I'd been laying, got home from work, and just my normal routine was to look after my dog and cat, and then just lay on the floor and just writhe in pain until I went to bed. And so very seldom did I get up and make myself a meal or anything. And then the angels, not to my awareness at that time, told me to phone the crisis center, because I thought, I'll try to find some help here. And so anyway, I did phone the crisis center, and the lady was so lovely to me and suggested I asked if I had a friend who I could go and stay with. So anyway, it's all in my book about what happened. And I followed her advice, and I did go to my friend's place, who was 2.5 hours away from me. We did go to emergency in the hospital, and I was turned away because I didn't live in that area.
Shocking. I'm just going to say shocking, but they have their rules.
Yeah, but she knew exactly what my plan was.
Wow.
Not the timeline, but that I was very, very suicidal. And, you know, I was turned away because I didn't live in that area.
So did you feel unsupported?
Oh, at that time, it even more, it even clarified even more that there was no help, because that was the first time I had reached out for help.
Yeah.
And then, you know.
You don't get it. Sorry, go to, yeah.
So here, all I want to just say is about MAID and living and dying. From my perspective, is there are two facts, two true things that I know for sure for me. I was born and I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Okay. Those two things are absolutely,
yeah. Fact.
Nobody can dispute that.
Right.
And I think that from my understanding and conversations with many, many people, that many people are afraid of death. And mm-hmm. I think that if we embrace death and we talked about it, and we had conversations about it, mm-hmm. instead of like as we were saying in the beginning, we talk frequently about what's going to happen and our plans for when one of us goes,
mm-hmm.
especially me being on my own. And mm-hmm. so having my family, you know, knowing my things are going to be taken care of for me when I no longer live here. But what I want to say is that if we embraced the fact that we're going to die instead of being so deathly scared of it.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon the pun there, but you know, I missed that. I must be asleep. No.
Wake up for soul sisters.
I just caught it too. But anyway, it's just what came out. It just what came out of my mouth is that we would not be afraid of the process because no matter how we look at it, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to happen, guys. Everybody on this planet is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a fact. And, you know, there's nobody can dispute that. The one thing that I learned very, very early on was when I was 13, I wanted to always go to Australia. And that was my dream back when I was 13 for many, 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 many.
I remember that. So I remember that.
Yeah. And I had to do a project for geography, and we were able to choose a country, and I chose Australia. Anyway, as I was doing my research and learned through the years, I'm not sure if I believe it's the Aborigines. So please forgive me if I'm incorrect here, but that it is a group of people who live in the desert in Australia, that when it is their time to go, they choose the day and how they're going to go. Like they have, it's a ceremonial process. So they go to the place that they've chosen, and they, I guess, create their sacred space, and they just let their organs die.
Cool.
And so it's a very spiritual process.
Mm.
And I remember this from, you know, learning this from the age of 13. And so I thought to myself, like, if we were so in touch with our own bodies and our minds about when we knew it was the actual time that we wanted to leave this process, this earth, and design our own sort of death process.
Yes.
You know, like sort of like a wedding. We plan, we make all these great festivities when we're planning weddings, or a lot of people do, but make it a very, and again, a lot of people do. I'm not saying the people that there are people who don't, obviously, but make it a ceremonial thing. And that's what this was for the Aborigines or the tribes that did this. It was a ceremony, and everybody in the village joined in with the ceremony and honoring this person's life as they chose to leave the planet in earthly form. And so I never forgot that. And so to me, I absolutely embrace death.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not afraid to die. With me, it's only I'm not ready to die. Mm-hmm. So when I'm ready to die, I will absolutely be okay to die. Today, I'm not ready to die. And if it's not my time to go today, then I will not go today. But I already believe that that's destined anyway, and it will happen at the time that I have chosen, the appropriate time that I have chosen to leave. So what I would really encourage the human species that don't embrace death as much as they embrace life, you know, I think that it would just absolutely be paramount to changing a whole ream of things in how people go through life.
I want to say two things while you were talking. I'm smiling a little bit because I just finished editing an episode with a chaplain.
Mm.
I love her. And I should put a little note to that episode. But anyway, her name is Sherry Ottoman, and it'll be available under my guest interview episodes on YouTube or in the audio form. But anyway, she's in her early 40s, and we were talking all about this. And as a chaplain, a hospice chaplain, and she's around, her death is her life. She loves it, by the way. She's really excited by funerals. I love you, Sherry, if you're watching this. But anyway, you know, she confirmed this is a cultural thing. It's cultural around the world, and different cultures. I also did an episode on a death culture around the world, but and she reaffirmed that different cultures embrace the passing as it's ritualistic, traditional, celebratory, however they want to do it, but they do it as community, and therefore it's far less scary and lonely to think about one's passing. And Sherry said that absolutely we've been conditioned culturally to basically go, ooh, when you mention the word.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I wanted to just say that. But the other piece I wanted to say while you were talking was, it just came to me, maybe the angels, is if you're contemplating this whole thing about, well, I don't want to be here, but I don't know, I certainly don't want to die, but I really don't want to be here. And you're in the struggle. Sherry called it the, greatest tension for the human species is to even consider our mortality. And then once we've considered our mortality, for most people, especially if they've got a good life, well, they don't want it to end.
Mm-hmm.
There could be the two, but well, we're also addressing here those that are struggling with their mortality and not wanting to be here. What came to me was ask yourself if you're ready to go. That's what triggered me. You said you would just know you're not ready to go. Me either. And if not, why not? You're still here, so you're here for a reason. And this is very different. Again, acknowledging this is not talking about people who are struggling with mental disorders.
Right.
Such as suicidal ideation, that is a whole different ball of wax.
Right.
But I had to accept and I had to consider when my daughter took her life at the age of 22. And I'm telling you, folks, she was a wise soul. Was she not?
Mm-hmm.
She is an old soul.
She was, very much.
I mean, holy crap. And a lot of bereaved parents say they learn that when their child has died, their child was the teacher, not the parent. So I do believe for a large segment number of children who leave us, their job is done. I was just talking with a bereaved parent about this. Their job is done. She felt the same losing her only child. If someone can feel that way about losing their only child, right? I'm okay thinking about that losing my one, but their job was done. And it forced me to not only consider my mortality, but the mortality of all my family, especially my remaining child, who's 31, and I still worry about him. But my struggle there is understanding if he goes before me, I have to accept it. Like, I can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's a tiny bit of a comfort for anyone struggling, scared their child's going to go, scared their partner's going to go, scared anybody's going to go but them, you can't do anything about it. Because as we talked last episode, exit points, but also it's great keeping it on the spiritual and, sort of contemplating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Theorizing. But when you actually are going through it, such as you had to experience it because of pain, I did because of bereavement, it puts it in a very different light. And I had to work really hard inwardly to really want to embrace this life authentically, which meant staying here. Right?
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're not ready to go, ask yourself why you aren't ready to go, and it might put you in touch a little bit with your purpose.
Exactly.
And a purpose can just be getting your feet on the floor. Okay. So, wow, that was a great conversation about that. And I did cover pretty much the points. Is there any last thing that you want to talk about before I give you a teaser about what we're talking about in part five?
No, I think I'm pretty complete.
Pretty complete, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a little bit of a teaser. Thanks for listening to us. We often, chat like this. And I'm really blessed that I do have you as a sister to be able to have these conversations with.
Vice versa, dear.
Yeah, because for us that, each of us choosing a spiritual path, choosing to entertain more than just the human experience in this world, you got to talk about it and
theorize a little bit and wonder and be curious and just, well, what if?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, you know, for me, I don't think I could have survived this in just this human.
Oh.
Like, but I was always very curious from very young age as well, just like you were. So and we were meant to discover our higher consciousness, tap into that higher consciousness, I guess I should say, at probably quite young ages.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm forever grateful for that.
Me too. And the one thing I'll say too about my sister and I is through our differences, we have found our similarities.
Yeah.
You know,
it's kind of fun.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah, kind of
it's
fun.
Really
glad to do it before we die. Okay. All right. I like to joke a little bit. Anyway, so next episode, I should say, in part five, what we're going to be talking, Brenda was mentioning earlier that she rafted the rapids and you paddled and paddled. And something I picked up from your book is how, you know, you have the rafting paddle and flip drill as an analogy for life. That's all I'm going to say, paddle and a flip drill. We are going to be talking when it's time to stop at the river's edge and why. And we're going to share with you a little bit about how we work with angels, bring some angels into this, and how you can work with them too, or at least invite them into your life, even if it's just to a small degree. So thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Until next time, we are the Soul Sisters. See you next time.